I don't know if the parties were present in the courtroom when I made comment regarding Justice Pickering. She is, as you can see, in Las Vegas and can, of course, see and hear everything in the same way that we can. But one thing that does make her presence a little different than ours is the fact that there's about a second or so delay when she tries to ask a question or when you try to respond to her. So just be mindful of that. Other than that, there's no interruption at all. It's just that little bit of a delay between the two locations. And are the parties ready to proceed?
Yeah.
Very well. Mr. Verlander?
May it please the court. I'm Richard Verlander, counsel for appellants Keith and Dina Hines. If I may, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. The Hineses are requesting this court reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment against their claims for wrongful foreclosure, fraud, and declaratory relief because Linda did not demonstrate it was entitled to summary judgment as a matter of law and because there exist substantial material issues of fact with respect to the Hineses' so-called default, the effect of the notice of rescission, and the fraudulent manner in which Linda obtained the foreclosure mediation certificate.
Please set forth for me the elements of the fraud that you claim took place in this case. I know there is a debate between the 2007 and the 2009 notice of rescission, but I want to know how it is that, I guess two things. The fraud that you suggest that was committed by the respondents, number one, please describe that to me, and number two, how it is that you say there was a wrongful foreclosure in this case.
Well, Your Honor, with respect to the fraudulent procurement of the foreclosure mediation certificate, the Hines' attorney had represented to Linda, both National Default and Wells Fargo, that the Hineses wanted to mediate.
The attorney did so how?
She did so telephonically. It took place on January 20th. This is undisputed in the record. Now, at the same time, Ms. Landholt informed both Wells Fargo and National Default that the December 2009 default was not compliant both under the HAMP guidelines, which is a federal program, as well as Nevada's recently implemented foreclosure rules for foreclosure of owner-occupied housing. Ms. Landholt informed Linda at that time that once a proper default had been taken, that the Hineses did, in fact, want to mediate and that they would return the mediation election form at that time. And so when Linda then submitted its affidavit in an attempt, and it's a successful attempt, to obtain the mediation certificate saying that they didn't return the form, while it is true they did not return the form, they had informed Linda that they wanted to mediate, that they were...
Returned the form, didn't make payments, didn't appear, didn't comply with any discovery request, didn't appear in court for numerous proceedings.
Well, first of all, with respect to the default, Your Honor, the Hineses have alleged that Linda contributed to or created the default.
How?
Well, they misapplied payments. They told them, they instructed them not to make certain payments. And so under those circumstances, the Hineses may not have been in default in the absence of the misapplication of payments and the absence of instructions not to make payments.
But you don't dispute the fact that if you lay this out on a linear chronology, that there was the original loan, there was a modification thereof, there was ultimately two notice of defaults, and there was, along that chronology, an apparent lack of payment repeatedly, not just once, not just twice, but there were long periods of time. And notwithstanding, I understand the record that there were certain factors at play here that may or may not be related to why they couldn't make their payments. I think the record itself is very clear. Payments were not made for a period of years. Is that a fair statement?
Well, subsequent to March of 2010, Your Honor, the foreclosure occurred in August 3rd of 2010. And so from March, where they made a partial payment of $700 from money that the Hineses had received for the Reno Cancer Foundation to pay for Mr. Hines' cancer operation, that was the last payment they made. The foreclosure occurred approximately 5 months later on August 3rd, and then the Hineses remained in the house for a period of time after that. They have been evicted subsequently and are no longer residing in the house.
So I'm sorry, when was the March payment? Where in the record is that supported?
I believe the March payment
Rather than derail your argument, maybe you could bring it back, that site, when you come back up.
Yes, Your Honor. So, with respect, I think it's important to point out that the Hineses were not trying to exploit these circumstances for personal gain. They were not deadbeats. They were not, living in a house and trying to buy a house that was way outside of their means. They were trying to save their home in the midst of severe personal difficulties, including Mr. Hines' cancer and an injury to Mrs. Hines that took her out of the workforce temporarily. Now, Nevada's foreclosure mediation program in Chapter 107.400 through 107.560 of Nevada's revised statutes are designed to ensure that lenders and borrowers have a reasonable and meaningful opportunity to avoid foreclosure by exchanging information and mediating. The Hineses didn't have this opportunity, and as a result of lenders' multiple misrepresentations and contradictory instructions, the Hineses lost their home, they lost the equity in their home, and they had improper discovery sanctions awarded against them.
Mr. Rolander, when the notice of default is recorded, I believe by law there's the instructions are given how to request a mediation and all by the trustor of the deed of trust and what they have to do and pay the $200 fee, and the lender has to pay the $200 fee, and then it goes through the process. So I think that to get mediation, though, your client would have to make the request and file the paperwork and pay the $200 and all to get there. Can you tell us what happened in that regard? Because I'm not sure how this fraud occurred or how you allege it occurred regarding that.
Yes, Your Honor. So the December 2009 notice of default was recorded on December 17th. Mm-hmm. Now, the Hineses contacted attorney Stephanie Landholt, who began to represent them. She contacted the lender, both Wells Fargo and National Default, on January 20th, 2010.
Let me cut to the chase. Did she do anything other than make the phone call? Did she return the FMP form?
No, she did not, Your Honor.
Okay.
However, I will say that on the 21st, the day after that phone call, where Ms. Landholt informed Wells Fargo and National Default that their December 2009 default was improper and not in compliance with the law and that it needed to be rescinded, the notice of rescission was recorded the very next day. Now, certainly there is dispute over the intent and the effect of that notice of rescission, but given the timing, I can't stress the importance enough about the proximity between that phone call and then the following day, the notice of rescission was recorded.
It rescinds the 2007 NOD, doesn't it?
No, it does not, Your Honor.
And that how?
Well, that is the conclusion the district court arrived at.
By matching numbers, as I recall from the record.
Well, there were file numbers in the header of the document. These numbers meant absolutely nothing to anybody who is not an employee of National Default. The district court arrived at that conclusion because it didn't view the evidence in a light most favorable to the Hineses as it was required to do when considering a motion for summary judgment.
I noticed in your demonstrative board where it has the instrument number, the book, the page, and the date, it's all blank then like that?
Yes, Justice Gibbons. So by each one of these arrows, this one sentence is the purpose of this document. All National Default had to do was include the date the default was recorded on, the instrument number, and the book and page number where it was recorded. And that would have let everybody know what was intended. Under these circumstances, especially considering the proximity in time, being the day after Ms. Landholt called and informed them that the 2009 December default was improper, I believe it is just as reasonable to assume that this document was actually intended to apply to the 2009 default and that whoever included the file number, that may have been a mistake. The affidavit of Ms. Todd did not include any statement saying that was based on personal knowledge. And, in fact, there's no evidence in the record that Ms. Todd was even employed by National Default at any time relevant to this appeal.
So your argument is there's a genuine issue of material fact as to what notice of default was rescinded because of the absence of this information in the rescission notice then. And as such, your client thought it was a 2009 versus 2007 and didn't file the paperwork for foreclosure mediation because they believed the notice of default had been rescinded then.
Absolutely. And they were expecting this to happen, and they didn't believe they were in default as a result of the various communications they had with Linda. So I believe this does actually create a material issue of fact that should have precluded summary judgment.
Okay.
Now, with respect to the foreclosure mediation certificate, again, the only evidence regarding the actual procurement of that certificate was Mrs. Todd's affidavit. I believe that affidavit is incompetent for the reasons stated, and it is undisputed that Ms. Landholt had a conversation with Wells Fargo in National Default the day before this was filed. The communication between Ms. Landholt and Linda creates a material issue of fact that should have prevented summary judgment. And I see I'm past my 10 minutes. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Thank you, Mr. Remender.
Please do find that March site for me, if you would, the record site.
The payment that you allege the Hineses made in March, partial payment, I believe it was, Justice Pickering is looking for that record citation.
I will find it, and when I have my time for rebuttal, I will include that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Kelly Dove. I am with Snell and Wilmer, and I represent Wells Fargo Bank. With me is Kevin Soderstrom with Tiffany and Bosco, who represents NDSC, and I will endeavor to cede the last approximately 3 to 4 minutes of respondents' time to Mr. Soderstrom. Pelham's had a history of default starting in 2006 and continuing all the way up to the time of foreclosure in August of 2010. The opening brief is replete with the history of the Hines missed payments, loan modifications, more missed payments, forbearance agreements, more missed payments, and finally foreclosure. However, except for the fact of default, virtually none of that history is really material to the issues before the court today. Indeed, appellants assert here and there that the 2009 notice of default was improper or somehow invalid, but really don't raise that argument or support it with any law anywhere.
What about the blanks in it as far as the reference to the rescission notice not referencing the book and document number of the notice of default that's been rescinded?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is definitely at issue. It's just that the validity of the initial recording of the 2009 notice of default, I believe, is not at issue. I think what clearly has been raised is whether that notice of rescission rescinded the 2007 or 2009, but at the time the 2009 notice of default was recorded, there's been no argument that that was somehow invalid. So you're just my own.
I guess I'm trying to, what was the date the rescission notice that was put up here on the board was recorded in reference to the 2009 notice of default? Which was recorded first?
Well, the 2009 notice of default was recorded in December 2009, and the notice of rescission was recorded January 21st, 2010. And interestingly, Mr. Verlander represented that his client had somehow relied on that notice of rescission and not submitting foreclosure mediation paperwork. However, the foreclosure mediation paperwork would have been due by January 16th, having allowed that 30 days to run to respond to the foreclosure mediation paperwork. So that deadline had passed before the notice of rescission.
But can't you see how an average layperson would be confused if a notice of default is recorded, then they subsequent to the recording they get a notice of rescission, being confused as to which one was recorded if it doesn't reference a specific recording date and book and instrument number and all? I mean, I think a lot of people would be confused by that, and maybe because if the notice of default is rescinded, there's no right to foreclosure mediation because there is no foreclosure.
Absolutely, that notice of rescission is missing key information from almost start to finish. There's a couple of points about that, though. Number one, the Hines did not rely on that in any respect and, in fact, did not even find out about the notice of rescission until after the foreclosure had occurred. So there was no reliance during the course of these foreclosure proceedings or negotiations where the Hines knew about the notice of rescission or relied on it. I think the issue with the notice of rescission is really a question of law, and that is, what effect should this notice of rescission have, given that it's missing virtually every key piece of information that you would need to know what it's referring to.
So your argument is we can ignore the notice of rescission because it is essentially a fugitive document. It tells us nothing.
Yes.
And we can instead rely upon the 2009 notice of default and the failure of the Hines to follow the FMP rules and procedures thereafter.
Yes. I think there's two ways the court could reasonably look at this this notice of rescission. One is that it's just missing so much key information that it should not be given any effect. I mean, I know the term ambiguity is used throughout some of the briefing, and in some ways it's ambiguous, but I think it's more ambiguous because of circumstances than it is because of its contents. If there had only been one notice of default before the notice of rescission, we could probably all stand here and agree that it applied to one, you know, the only notice of default. But because there are two existing notices of default and one notice of rescission, that raises the question of which one it applied to. Now, the district court, I think, reasonably matched the numbers, which are on the face of the two documents. I mean, it might not be apparent to the
average. May I pause for a moment? Let's take the 2007 one off the table, and I'm running this hypothetically. Where would you be if there had only been the one 2009 notice of default followed by the notice of rescission?
Well, I think it still should not be given any effect because it's missing such key information. In fact, some cases, though not from Nevada, suggest that when a recorded document is missing key pieces of information, it should not be recorded. It should not have been recorded in the first place. It doesn't provide the constructive notice such recorded documents are meant to provide and should give no effect.
That your client deserved summary judgment, even though the on the basis that after the notice of rescission, the FMP documents were never returned?
That's correct. And the trustee did not commit fraud in any respect in preparing the certificate. Under the foreclosure mediation rules, specifically Rule 8, subsections 2 to 4, it's very clear in mandatory language that to elect mediation, the homeowner must return the written document to the administrator and pay the fee within the 30 days. And subsection 4 states that failure by an eligible participant to timely deliver an election of mediation shall result in the administrator issuing a certificate stating that no mediation is required.
What if there is a reason for being late? Like, let's say you're out of town and you didn't get it, and you come back and you say, hey, I'm 2 days late. Would there be any room for forgiveness on that delay?
Well, I mean, it's mandatory, but the rules are not quite at the level of a statute. So, arguably, I think this court could indulge that, though that's not close to what happened here. Here, the Hines alleged that Wells Fargo and NDSC committed fraud by submitting an affidavit, but the affidavit was actually entirely correct because there's two items that the trustee can select from on that affidavit, which is at 223 in the record. One indicates that the homeowner explicitly waived their right to mediation, not checked in this case. Here, the trustee checked, failed to return to the form upon which foreclosure mediation could be elected or waived, which is the truth. I mean, there's no dispute that the Hines did not return the form. The trustee submitted an affidavit checking the box that the Hines didn't return the form and were issued a certificate pursuant to that representation, which there's just no dispute that that's
true. So the analysis follows much like an unopposed motion in the district court can be granted on that basis alone.
Yes, I mean, failure to return the form. I think it would be a very different argument if they were 2 days late, but I don't think the phone call that occurred, that allegedly occurred in this case at all, is comparable to returning the form 2 days late. Even the testimony, if it is admissible and taken at face value, the testimony that the Hines recounted that Ms. Landholt allegedly said was, you need to get rid of this foreclosure and start a new one, and then we're going to apply for mediation. So it's not even saying we would like to apply for mediation in this case, which would itself be insufficient, but it's saying you need to get rid of the 2009 notice of default, then we'll go through mediation once you file a new one.
The rules require written notice.
That's correct. And they clearly require written notice.
My concern is this, and I understand your arguments and all, but the National Default Servicing Corporation, I guess, who recorded the notice of rescission, is the agent of Wells Fargo, is the agent of the beneficiary. It's representing, acting on behalf of the trustee of the deed of trust. So if there is, let's say, a hypothetical negligent misrepresentation here, I mean, that would be attributable to your client based upon their improper actions and not recording that document properly with the necessary information. Do you agree with that?
And would that be recording, I'm sorry, Your Honor, what?
Well, I'd be recording a notice of rescission in such a way after the, a month after the notice of the notice of default was recorded in December of 2009. Mm-hmm. This was recorded in January of 2010, so it's about a little over a month apart. And it's it says notice of rescission of the foreclosure proceedings, the notice of default and election to sell, but it doesn't fill in the information there, meaning the date the notice of default was recorded. You see, if it's said on the on that document, we're rescinding the notice of default in 2007, then you see that right on the face of the rescission notice. By leaving it blank, though, I think a person could assume that it was rescinding the 2009 notice, which would obviate the need to file a request for closure mediation because there is no foreclosure pending at that time. That's my concern, and it's just the timing on this. If it bothers me, you know, like that and that time frame. Now, whether it's intentional fraud or not, I mean, you know, I understand your point, but it's a summary judgment, so we have to renew this de novo and just see if there's any type of material issue of facts. So that's my concern in reviewing the case, and I appreciate your thoughts on that.
Sure. Well, if I could point out that the time had already expired by the time this notice
by
of rescission.
By a couple days or something.
Well, by almost a week, and then they never did submit one. I mean, and Ms. Hines, in her deposition, I believe at page 535, acknowledged that she did not even learn about the notice of rescission until they were bringing the lawsuit more than 9 months later. So those two things have
so
just...
So you're saying she couldn't have relied on it.
She couldn't have relied on it. They admitted not knowing about it.
Okay.
And just also that the district court properly considered parole evidence and conduct of the parties in interpreting the document. And while appellants say, no, you shouldn't treat it as a contract, no, you shouldn't treat it as a deed, they really don't offer a theory of how it should be treated, where all the law, at least I could locate out there, suggests, you know, you go for intent when you can, you look at parole evidence when you need to, whether it's a deed, whether it's a contract. You construe those documents as much as you can from the plain language and then from intent. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Dutt.
Excuse me. Could I have the citation again to the testimony of the plaintiff in deposition?
I believe it was page 535.
535. Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Soderstrom? You have 3 minutes and 18 seconds.
Thank you. Good morning. Kevin Soderstrom for National Default Servicing Corporation. My client joins in the points and authorities set forth by Wells Fargo in its answering brief, which we've incorporated into our brief by reference and also the oral argument today. First, I would just like to cover 3 points quickly. First, as stated on page 5 of Wells Fargo's answering brief, at page 535 of the appendix, I'd just like to quote the 4 lines. This is deposition testimony from Dina Hines given under oath. Question, do you recall ever getting anything called a notice of rescission? Answer, we didn't get that. I didn't find out about that until I went to the county recorder's office. Question, when was that? Answer, that was after they sold the house. To the extent that the appellants are arguing, continue to argue today, that the notice of rescission caused confusion or caused them to not elect mediation or to act or refrain from acting in any way, there's simply no basis for it. And that's the theory of liability.
Let me pause you there for a moment. They had a lawyer who called and spoke to someone on January 20th, and I believe they spoke to someone employed by your client on January 20th. Why is it not fair to infer, and this is summary judgment, not trial, that perhaps the lawyer felt that the notice of rescission, that the lawyer knew about the notice of rescission and believed that that took care, that that was in response to that call? I mean, your opposing counsel makes the point, you have the call on January 20th, and then on January 21st, you have the notice of rescission that would seemingly have been response to the January 20th call. I get that, you know, ultimately intentional fraud is very difficult to prove, et cetera, but in the summary judgment context, I'm troubled by that.
Sure. I don't think that we can infer that the call, the alleged call, brought up the issue of the notice of rescission, which hadn't even been done at that point in time. Second of all, that's not an allegation that they've made. They've alleged that it was that the phone call was made regarding the notice of default, not the notice of rescission.
Sure, but the argument is, what I'm maybe I'm not clear, that the call was about the notice of default, and the maker of the call would know about the notice of rescission and see it as a response to the call challenging the notice of default and assume if the foreclosure were going to proceed, there would be a new notice of default. I think that's what Justice Gibbons and I are both troubled by.
And I would respond that that's not, those are not the allegations that were brought before the district court. They proceeded on a different theory of liability, and I know my time is short, so I'll just quickly address the last two points. Number one, the foreclosure sale happened August 3rd, 2010. At the time, NRS 107.080, subsection 5, was discretionary. It said a sale made pursuant to this section may be set aside if there is a lack of substantial compliance. We don't agree that there is. We don't think they've shown it. But even if we were to take that as true, it's still discretionary. And finally, the last point, summary judgment was given after the close of discovery in this case. The district court did not rush to judgment. They allowed time for discovery. If the appellants had chosen, they could have done some discovery. They didn't do that. The district court properly granted summary judgment based on a clear set of facts that it had before it, and we don't think that the judgment should be overturned or sent back. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Verlander.
Yeah, Mr. Verlander should come up. I certainly appreciate that you were not trial counsel. In fact, you picked up this case on our pro bono project on appeal, and we understand that. But we are confined by the arguments which were made by your clients to the district court when they represented themselves. So, did they ever make the argument that they relied upon this notice of rescission at any time and not going forward with the foreclosure mediation process?
No, they did not rely on the notice of rescission. They relied on lender's communication with their attorney that indicated that the 2009 default was going to be withdrawn and reissued and proceed from there in a proper fashion. At this point, I would like to answer Justice Pickering's previous question regarding the $700 partial payment in March of 2010, and you can find that in the appellant's opening brief on page 7 at the top. In the record, you can find it at 4 ROA 474, which is the deposition transcript of Mr. Hines, at page 64, lines 3 through 6, 4 ROA 533, at pages 20, lines 25 to 21, I'm sorry, pages 20, starting at line 25 to page 21 to line 16, which is Mrs. Hines' deposition transcript, and then 5 ROA 745 and 757. Now, I'd like to point out a couple of things. the notice of rescission was not necessary to foreclose. They didn't need to rescind the 2007 notice of default. And so it would make no sense for them to do that. The only possible purpose the notice of rescission could have been recorded was either to rescind the 2009 notice of default as a result of the January 20th, 2010 conversation, or if you were to take a more sinister view of things, is to intentionally mislead individuals into thinking that the 2009 notice of default was rescinded.
Well, the other reason would be they rescind the 2007 because it's out of date as far as the evidence of what's in default, and under NRS 107080, you would have 35 days. I think it's now 90 days to cure your delinquent installments. So that could have been a reason they updated the notice of default and then rescinded the 2007 notice. Correct? I mean, am I wrong or that?
No, Your Honor. I do not believe you are wrong, but I do not believe that the rescission of the 2007 was a condition precedent to going forward with a foreclosure under a different notice of default.
Okay.
And I want to follow the comment that you made and the comments of my colleague, Justice Gibbons, regarding the fact that you're stuck with the record that you get. Where in the pleadings can you point this court to the arguments that you're making here today? And you're making great arguments. Let it be clear.
Thank you, Justice. You know, quite frankly, the issues, the notice of rescission was argued in the Hines' opposition to Linda's second motion for summary judgment that did apply to the 2009 default. Now, I may be expanding on those arguments somewhat, but I do not think I am going beyond the record.
But they did make that argument before the district court. You know.
And I asked for where in the pleading is that argument made?
And I do not have that information before me. If it's permissible, I would be happy.
We could find it in the opposition to the second motion for summary judgment.
I believe so, Your Honor.
What say you in response to your opponent's point that Mrs. Hines admitted in deposition at page 535 that she never saw the notice of rescission, didn't know anything about it, and couldn't have been confused by it or relied on it?
Well, as I've said, the reliance wasn't on the notice of rescission. The reliance was on the communication with the Hines' attorney on January 20th. And that communication indicated that the 2009 default would be rescinded and reissued in a compliant manner.
And the you read the notice of rescission as confirmation of your version of that telephone call, is what your point is?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Justice?
Yes. The notice of rescission, then, is significant to your side because you're saying it supports the accuracy of the lawyer's affidavit that says, I had this call and we understood they were going to rescind the NOD. And indeed they did the day after.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I see.
With that, I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Verlander. Ms. Dove and Mr. Soderstrom, for your arguments here today, the matter will stand submitted.